This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers.
Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And today we're bringing you an episode about election law and constitutional law. And I got to have a great conversation with a fellow election law professor named Edward Foley. He is a chair in constitutional law at Ohio State University, where he also directs its election law program. His writing and teaching focuses in part on voting system design, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, and electoral reform. He's a leading expert on election law, and we talked about his book, Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. I hope you enjoy this conversation half as much as I did. Please, as always, rate, review, and subscribe. Professor Foley, thank you for joining us. I'm really excited about this conversation. And because the Supreme Court has been in the news a lot lately, not necessarily because of their decisions, although we are approaching June, but because of the justices' extracurricular activities and their spouses' activities, I wanted to begin by talking a little bit about your time clerking on the Supreme Court for Justice Blackmun. So I want to start by asking you, because so few people ever get that experience, what most surprised you about serving as a clerk on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me, and please call me Ned as a colleague. What surprised me before the clerkship, I joked that anyone can do anything for a year because I had heard clerking was rigorous and arduous, particularly for Justice Blackmun. And I managed to get through 10 months unscathed, and then I got sick that caused me to miss a week at a period of time that was not ideal in terms of the flow of the court's work. And I bounced back and finished it out, but I learned something that you can't necessarily do anything for an entire year.
I believe that the term that you clerked, 1988 to 89, Justice Blackmun had some fairly stinging criticism of his colleagues that term. And I'm wondering if, from your perspective as a clerk, in comparing that court to this court, do they actually feel like they were maybe more collegial back then? Or is it always that they're just nine people in the most powerful law firm in the world trying their best to get along with different ideological perspectives?
Yeah. What was interesting and significant about that year was that it was the first year that Justice Kennedy was on the court, the first full term, and the swapping out of Justice Powell retiring and then Justice Kennedy coming in, you know, was a significant shift in the court's median justice and the dynamic of the court. And that can be very unsettling for the rest of the justices who are there and who had settled into one pattern and then suddenly saw something new. Compared to today, I think the relatively modest shift in the court's direction, where Powell was in the driver's seat versus Kennedy, you know, is dwarfed compared to the really enormous shift in jurisprudence as a result of the recent transformations. But you know, is it a difference in degree or a difference in kind? In any event, I do think that year was a pivotal year in the way that right now is even more of a pivot point.
So let's talk a little bit about their conduct and then a little bit about the decisions. Recently, the latest news we're recording this episode on May 24th is that Justice Alito and or his wife flew flags at their home and their vacation home that were viewed as supportive of the Stop the Steal movement. Of course, we all know about Justice Clarence Thomas's spouse, Jenny Thomas, who was involved in planning some of the speeches on January 6th leading up to the, let's charitably call it, events in the Capitol that day. When you look at those pieces of behavior, those actions, what do you think the public sees and what do you see?
Yeah, it is concerning. I mean, just for sake of being candid, my wife and I decided long ago we were going to adopt a no yard signs policy at our own house because I wanted to, you know, being an election law professor that wanted to be fair-minded and call it like I see it and be nonpartisan and portray a public image consistent with my philosophy of being an election law professor, that I'm supposed to be impartial in that respect. And I may have opinions and views, but I want to signal that I try as hard as I can to think about elections from a fair process point of view. And I'm not trying to equate the role of a law professor at a state university with the Supreme Court of the United States, but I would have thought if, you know, somebody like me has a no yard sign, a policy that affects my wife as well as me. I mean, she's an independent person. She's got her own political views, but we act in concert as we think about this. You know, I would have thought something similar would go on at the household of a justice.
Well, we similarly have that policy in my house. I similarly am married to somebody with his own beliefs, political and otherwise. And what I hear you saying, which I think is so important, is we're both acknowledging it might just look like when we're doing our jobs that we're somehow biased. And that is, I think, what troubles me about the current behavior of the justices and or their spouses, is that the appearance doesn't seem to bother them. Were there historical corollaries to this type of behavior that you can think about? I don't remember this, but I try not to fall victim to the, you know, semi-hysteria of this is just different. These are just politicians in robes.
Right. Well, I think it depends on, you know, what point in history you do the comparison. I think if you go all the way back, you know, to the founding era or shortly after, I think we would be startled at the behavior of some of the federal judges as there got to be this huge fight between the so-called Federalist Party and the Jeffersonians. And, you know, by the modern canons of judicial behavior, some of that would look very suspicious. I think, you know, for good reasons, in the 20th century, we tended to develop a culture that expected more of our judges. And so if we're talking about the period when I was clerking, I think all the justices strove very hard to have their public profile be consistent with what was then the, you know, prevailing conception of judicial behavior. I do think that our culture has shifted and social media has affected this. Judges are writing more books in addition to opinions than they ever used to do. They're giving more speeches. They're going to more Aspen Institutes and things like that overseas or in this country. And so I think they've gotten themselves into a position where their non-judicial behavior can be questioned much more than the much more lower profile. I mean, if I can tell you one anecdote that sort of at least depicts how things were when I was clerking, you may know that one of the things that was unique about Justice Blackmun at the time is that every weekday morning we would have breakfast with him in the court's cafeteria. And that we sat off in the corner, and when we got there at 8 o'clock, it was closed to the public, but it would get open to the public by 9 o'clock, and we were often not finished our conversations at nine. And so sometime after nine, we would leave the cafeteria where there was already public getting their food and take the staircases up to the main hallway in the courthouse in order to get to his chambers. So we were not kind of kept from public view. I mean, we would be walking on that staircase before clerks and Justice Blackmun at the same time as a lot of members of the public were walking up and down. And I cannot recall a single day where I caught a member of the public kind of looking at Justice Blackmun and turning to one of their family members or friends and saying, "Oh, that's one of the justices. I just saw a justice." There was unbelievable anonymity, despite their power and their role in our society, that I suspect doesn't exist for any of them today, given their photos on the internet and so forth.
That's fascinating, the considering the power and then at the same time, the anonymity. And you said many of the justices are writing books. I want to talk a little bit about your one of your books. There's a revised edition for 2024, which I think is very appropriate. Ballot Battles, the History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And I'm hoping that we can start really from a basic level of helping people understand what we're talking about when we're talking about disputed elections, because I think for some people, it feels like it's, I'm running against you for city council, you win. And I said, no, you didn't. So what's the type of disputed election that we should really be thinking about? What falls within that definitional bucket as we're moving towards the 2024 elections? Not obviously, not just the presidential election, but there are down ballot races as well.
Sure. And the book covers a lot of down ballot races as well as some presidential races. But the philosophy of the book as I undertook this project and it grew was to focus on significantly disputed elections in each era or period of American history. And the reason for that, the original project was defined not as historical in nature, but almost a 50-state survey to find out what are the best practices in state law for adjudicating a dispute or conducting a recount. In other words, the circumstances in which there has been a vote and the election is complete and there's an initial tally, one side or the other says, wait a second, we don't think that tally is accurate. We think the government is declaring the wrong winner to be the winner. And we want to fight that one way or the other, whether administratively or in courts or what have you, through the legal process. I mean, the assumption was that these disputes would be handled by law. And that is, you know, thankfully, largely the way they've been handled in American history. Although there have been some other periods of violence where, mostly in the 19th century prior to January 6th, where the legal system didn't seem quite robust at the time for certain disputes of these natures. That was an eye-opener. But in any event, the goal was to say, well, you know, what's the best way to handle this? And as I was reading the doctrine in the cases that had been decided by courts in city council races or a legislative race or a mayor's race or what have you, I came to realize that as much as those courts were trying to decide these things in good faith, the system wasn't pressure tested in the way that a major dispute would be, and that you couldn't understand this topic simply by reading cases and thinking about doctrine. You had to think about the law in practice and what was going on the ground in the middle of a difficult dispute. And, you know, I undertook this project not immediately after the Bush versus Gore 2000 presidential election, but in the wake of that. I really started this project in earnest in 2007. It took a long time pulling it all together once it took the historical turn that it did. But Bush versus Gore gave me an inkling again of that if you sort of looked at the law ahead of time, before that dispute unfolded, and then you looked at what happened after it unfolded, sort of night and day. And so that was a realization that to understand how the system can handle these disputes, whether it can handle these disputes, what's the best way to handle these disputes, you need to do more than just look at the law and the books. And lawyers, we're trained to look for the most recent relevant precedent, right? We're not pure historian in the sense that we don't look at the past for its own sake. We look at the past to understand the present and the future. And so the most recent relevant precedent is more important than an older relevant precedent. And I ultimately felt I couldn't really understand this topic, you know, without going back to the beginning. I didn't want to do all this research, but trying to cabin myself to just 20th century precedents didn't feel like it was telling me the whole story. And And in fact, the story became to me that this has been a difficulty from our country from the very beginning, even though our conception of democracy has become transformed, right? We didn't even use the term democracy in the same way at the beginning, right? Only white men with property could vote, et cetera, et cetera. But despite all of the changes in those ways of our conception of self-government, there's been a belief that elections should be decided according to the rules and fairly and accurately. And yet it's often been difficult to implement that basic ideal in practice with more subsidiary rules when fighting gets very specific over different types of balance and different types of allegations. So it's an area of law that has been troublesome for our country. We're maybe, you know, from the long sweep of history, you know, we were getting better at it. I fear that, you know, with 2020 and where we are today, we've taken a turn for the worse, unfortunately.
So there's so many places where I want to follow up on what you just said. I think you used the term pressure tested, and I talk about the system not being stress tested. And are there specific places for people who are listening thinking, what do I need to be the most worried about, where you feel like this is, and I know you talk about this in the book, again, Ballot Battles, the History of Disputed Elections in the United States, and there's a revised edition that I want to recommend to everybody that was revised this year. Where do we see the biggest weaknesses in the joint where you think, oh my goodness, if I could just do three things, it would be these three?
Well, let me start and we'll see if I get to three or I need more. But So the first thing that is especially troubling right now compared to the whole sweep of history, and this is a theme of the revised edition, which should be out shortly in a matter of weeks from the publisher. What's unique about what Trump did in 2020 that we did not see before was this complete denial of basic reality and evidence. You know, every other major dispute, there was something plausible to fight about. They were genuinely fighting about whether there really was fraud in some instances, or there was enough mistakes administratively that it made a difference in the outcome. One side usually had the better claim. Sometimes it really felt like a jump ball in terms of the reasonableness of the position under the law and given the evidence. But no prior episode that I discovered or have since discovered had this component of, you know, it doesn't really matter what the empirical truth is, we're just going to claim fraud and that we won. And the only analogy that I could come up for it as I was watching 2020 unfold, and as we've been gripped with this, sometimes it's called election denialism since then, is the so-called McCarthy era, or the Red Scare of the 1950s. That obviously didn't involve elections, but it was another episode in history, which somewhat well-known political scientist, historian Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics. And he wrote a book in the wake of the McCarthy era comparing that then recent Red Scare to things like the Salem witch trials, or the know-nothing movement that was anti-immigration in the 19th century. So there have been episodes where there's been a kind of almost collective psychosis or hysteria in the body politic that thankfully goes away, but does last, unfortunately, for a significant period of time. The McCarthy era lasted, you know, 4 years from the moment that Senator McCarthy waved a piece of paper and said, I've got the names of the communists. And it was all fabricated. It was like Giuliani saying, I've got the names of the fraudulent voters. Similar, just nonsense. I mean, just deliberately fabricated lies. But charismatic politicians can sometimes get away with duping their public like that. But we've never had the confluence of this paranoid style with disputed elections. And that makes me particularly nervous because, I mean, it's bad enough to have a kind of collective psychosis over communists in the State Department. That's not good, but there's nothing more central to self-government than the voting process. So if we can't let ourselves be guided by facts and basic mathematics over voting. And instead, we create hysteria and conspiracy theories over that. That really goes to the heart of democracy and potentially undermines it.
As you were talking, and I know that you said at one point that we can't just look at the laws on the books when it comes to disputed elections. And then I heard you talking about this collective psychosis, this collective hysteria. And I can't help but wonder what your view as one of the nation's experts on the law in this area is as to whether or not the law can really handle our current reality. Because I think some of the issues here go far beyond if we just have a better election law, if we just have a better fill in the blank law. It seems to me that it goes beyond there's just better legislation, there's just better training when it comes to election administration. And is that part of what you see as well?
Yes. So one thought that came to me as I was working on the first edition, and I still believe is true, is I picture a triangle, you know, with three dimensions or elements to it in order to kind of have a successful system to handle the worst pressure tested moments that we've been talking about. So one point of the triangle are clear, precise rules, well-written rules, the law on the books. And you hope that you've anticipated every possible thing that could go wrong by writing these rules clearly, because litigation thrives on ambiguity and disputation. You know, again, if it's evidence-based and if it's reality-based, the more reality is clear-cut, the harder it is to complain about it. And so these complaints can kind of get out of control when the law is just unclear or didn't anticipate a situation. But the second point of the triangle is institutions that can handle an emergency, an election-related emergency in a recount context if it arises. One of the key lessons of the first edition, and again, still true, is that a losing side usually felt it was cheated wrongfully if the dispute resolution institution was controlled by the opposing party. But even in the context of ambiguity and genuine uncertainty, if the government had set up a genuinely bilateral neutral institution where each side felt represented and yet there was a neutral tiebreaker, that was capable of diffusing the conflict to the point where they said, okay, somebody had to win, somebody had to lose. We thought we should win, but we were treated fairly by the decisive institution. Hasn't happened as often as we would like in American history, despite calls for it throughout American history. But when it has happened, it's usually been quite successful. And then the third one is what we might call civic culture or civic virtue. You know, Madison famously said, government is not for angels, and we can't depend on, you know, pure virtue. But it is also true you can't make laws or institutions work when there's no virtue whatsoever. And there have been moments in history where the rules and institutions have been tested to the point that it really made a difference who were the human beings that were occupying seats of power and making decisions about what to do in the particular instance.
So I think that it's really helpful to think about the triangle or the three-legged stool. And I do want to ask, because I think a lot of us are going into the 2024 elections with a lot of anxiety, and some of it is somewhat abstract and some of it is somewhat amorphous. And you have a more specific view of the election system than many, many, many people throughout our country. And so I'm wondering, for those who are listening, what are some things that you want us to be on alert for? And I think I'll ask you for basically two different time frames. One is leading up to the election. What are things that we should be listening for, thinking about, maybe other than the obvious kind of misinformation and disinformation, where we can be sure that our ballots will be counted, We can be sure that we can have faith in the system, maybe regardless of what some people at the very top of our government are saying to us.
Yeah, thanks. This is really important. And there was sort of an example of the need for careful thinking, even in the news that broke today. The New York Times did a top of the front page of the website story on Trump's attempts to cast doubt on the system.
Yep.
And we're going to see more and more of that throughout the year. But from my research and thinking about elections, it's really important to distinguish between circumstances that potentially could undermine the validity of the outcome versus things that we may not like about our electoral system, but don't negate the choice that collectively we as citizens make. So disinformation is actually a good example of this. I mean, when we saw Russian disinformation in 2016, I was horrified by it. This is awful. This is bad. And it's right to complain about it in one respect, but it's not right to say that the votes that were cast, even if influenced by disinformation, are invalid votes and that the winner isn't really the winner.
Right. That's so important. I mean, you can have a mistaken belief, but you cast your ballot, no problem. It was counted, no problem. Those are really separate things.
Right. And in fact, just earlier today, I was listening to a different podcast with the CBS reporter John Dickinson, and he was pointing to a poll that said, a significant number of Americans are just factually mistaken about certain economic facts about whether inflation is, rising or falling, or the stock market is rising or falling. That may be true, but we live in a democracy and people are entitled to make the judgment about who to vote for whatever reasons they do. And I am worried when there's a temptation to try to delegitimize the result for those sorts of reasons that don't go to the authenticity of the votes cast, meaning a vote that's cast is authentic if the voter really wanted to cast that vote, whatever their underlying reason for doing so was. So I would hope the listeners here would sort of take that basic distinction in mind as they read all the news stories that are going to happen about what's truly potentially undermining the validity of the election versus what doesn't, even if we regret that it happened.
So I'm going to shout out to John Dickerson only because I got to talk to him last night about a recent Supreme Court case out of South Carolina. And we got to talk a little bit about voting rights. And I know that he spent a lot of time thinking about the education or lack thereof of the American public when it comes to some basic issues. But I promised that I would ask you two different timeframes leading up to the election and then after the election. And so I can imagine people at home are now waiting for part two. Now, it seems to me that it's somewhat similar in the sense of there's going to be some just false accusations that are going to flood the airwaves. And we need to be careful about that. But what are the moments where, for you as, again, one of the nation's experts in this area, you think, okay, now we're headed to something different than just lies? Like, these are accusations where there actually might be some sort of different type of breakdown in the system.
Yeah. So on this, I would say, despite whatever we think is troublesome about American democracy and our legal system right now, on this basic point, I do think we can trust the court. They did well in 2020 to adjudicate cases properly, and I think they will endeavor to adjudicate any claims that come their way according to the law. We do have to worry about some judges being, partisan and not following the law, but I think that can be overstated. And again, we have to evaluate it as we see it. So, if there are claims that come up that say, there were ballots counted in Wisconsin that were unlawful ballots that shouldn't be counted, you can't just make that allegation on cable news or, and social media. You have to have evidence and you have to go to court. We have procedures that are robust procedures for handling this. Despite, the lessons of the book and the issues that we've been troubled with, we have to start with the system that we have, and when claims are truly baseless, they will be rejected. it's also important to know that when the news media calls a race and declares so-and-so won, that has no legal standing whatsoever. You don't get an official result until there's been something called a canvassing of the returns. That can take weeks in most states, 2 or 3 weeks. And so, you know, the math gets double-checked and triple-checked. Georgia went through 3 recounts in 2020. You know, the idea that you needed cyber ninjas to do a fake audit to get the truth, again, that was the McCarthy hysteria. The best institutions that we have are current judicial institutions. Maybe we could design better ones in the future, but, you know, we got to rely on them. So I do think the good news is that Congress passed something called the Electoral Count Reform Act at the end of 2022. And that means that the entire decision process has to be conducted according to the rule of law as the rule of law exists. Now, I can't guarantee that the rule of law is going to be perfect, you know, 100% fair. It's administered by humans. Again, it may not have been completely clairvoyant, but we will, in that sense, get a rule of law answer, and Congress has pledged itself to be bound by that rule of law answer, regardless of what any governor does or legislature does or anybody else who tries to undermine the rule of law. So that is something to be positive about as we head into this election.
So you just said something, and I think this is where, because we're way over the amount of time I asked you for, this is maybe where I want to end, which is you said, you know, the media will call a state that has no legal consequence. And I think that's really important, even though, as you say it, it feels obvious, right? In the sense of the New York Times has no legal ability to say, and there we go, that's what happened. And so for people who are familiar with your work, they're going to know the words blue shift, and they're going to be screaming right now, how did you have Ned Foley on your podcast and not ask him about the blue shift? But I know there are a lot of people who are listening who might not know what we're talking about. So I think this is the perfect moment, because we're talking about what happens, you know, leading up to, but then also right after the election. What is this blue shift, and why is it something that we need to look out for?
Yeah, thanks. So this is something that I stumbled upon on election night in 2012. When I was trying to figure out, as we were hearing from the news media, what the vote counting was, to try to make a kind of back of the envelope calculation on when the tally would be sort of outside what election lawyers call the margin of litigation, right? The spread between the two candidates would be so wide that it wouldn't be worth fighting over. And as I was trying to make that calculation, as the returns were coming in, I went back to what happened in 08 and 04, and 2000 to think about the difference between what the results looked like on election night versus what the final certified result was in, because I didn't want to make a judgment about the margin of litigation based just on election night results if it would change significantly, you know, before you had the final official result. And when I did that calculation, I was astounded by the difference and how much vote tallies could shift during this canvassing period that we're talking about before certification. And, you know, I think I tweeted something out about it. Twitter, I think, was relatively new in 2012, but I wanted to let the world know, hey, wait a second, these numbers, you know, are provisional in nature. And then I thought, well, there's a law review article to write about this. And so I dug deep into it and discovered that really this phenomenon, and what it is that it turns out, for reasons that we can discuss, Democrats do better on late counted ballots. So Republicans do better, relatively speaking, on election night returns. And then I was using the metaphor that we learned in astronomy class or physics class about, you know, light from outer space being either blue shifted or red shifted. The point is that election returns get blue shifted towards the Democrats as more ballots get count. None of this is nefarious. All of these ballots are valid ballots. This is just a product of the way we do elections. But the way we do elections after 2000, for lots of good faith reasons, is different than before. We've got, because of those hanging chads and the improper voter purging of the rolls. We've now got provisional ballots when we never used to. We want easy access to vote by mail instead of long lines at the polls on election day. And all of these changes in the mechanics of election administration since 2000 have resulted in a phenomenon that, for demographic and other sociological reasons, the so-called blue vote comes in later. And having written that article that was then published in 2014 and explaining it and wanting to make sure that people understood it as best as possible, I got very worried in 2018 when I heard then President Trump, you know, wanting to shut the counting of ballots down in Florida's gubernatorial election, not even his own election. And he was crying fraud without any basis. And I say, oh my goodness, what's going to happen in 2020 when there's going to be a blue shift in his own election? And he's going to say it's illegitimate, as he ended up doing. But I do think the media at least got a better understanding of this phenomenon before 2020, so was prepared for it. Unfortunately, Trump still got away with, you know, infecting the public culture and believing that something wrong happened when nothing wrong happened.
So I'm going to ask the question that you kind of keyed me to follow up with, which is, why does this happen?
So we don't fully understand that. You know, as an election law professor, I can sort of understand the rules. There are other political scientists like Charles Stewart at MIT and Barry Burton at Wisconsin who are starting to dig deep on that. And I do think vote by mail has a larger role to play than the so-called provisional ballots. I think the evidence is showing that. What we did learn a lot as a result of COVID and the increased use of vote by mail, and this was even before Trump starts to badmouth vote by mail, you know, for his own purposes, whatever. But maybe it's because, again, of the kind of jobs the Democrats tend to have, maybe more, you know, or at least used to have compared to, you know, blue-collar jobs versus white-collar jobs, those sorts of things. You can imagine where some Democrats, you know, want to take advantage of more convenient voting opportunities than just going to their neighborhood polling place on election day. That certainly became more and more pronounced. We got a huge blue shift in 2020 precisely because of the combination of COVID and Trump badmouthing vote by mail. And it is vote by mail ballots that, because of some state laws and just some state practices, get counted later. Some states allow mail ballots to be considered valid as long as they're postmarked by election day, even if they arrive at the election officials' offices up to a week or 10 days later. Well, you can't possibly count a ballot that's still in the mail, but that was postmarked on time. And that, so that explains it in some states. Some states like Pennsylvania, unfortunately, still have a law that says absentee ballots can't be processed for eligibility until the polls close or until at least sometime on election day itself. Well, that, in a world where you have lots and lots more absentee ballots, they pile up for weeks and weeks and you can do nothing with it. And then they're the backlog. They're the last ballots counted because you can't count them until you verify the signature and verify the address and all that stuff on the envelope. So fortunately, most states have changed their rules on that, but some states are still outdated in that respect.
It's so interesting, Ned Foley. I really enjoyed our conversation. We covered everything from the Supreme Court to a little bit of astronomy to voting rights. And this was such a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it as well.